would stiffen sharply on the routes toward the command center and engineering. In the Terran's place, he would have let the attackers board and penetrate toward those targets while he got his people into armor. Even with anti-armor weapons, the Terrans had barely slowed his people down and had thrown away over 100 lives. "Tighten up your strikes," he ordered. "We're supposed to be condottieri, not thugs. Let's look the part, and it'll focus your firepower when they start throwing armor roadblocks in your way in about 3 minutes." "Teach your grandmother to knit," Riley told him genteelly. "Got a plan, boss?" "There's a lovely little promenade gallery about halfway between your current location and the command center," he noted as he studied the schematics. "Great place for an ambush, but closer to the hull than the command center is."
"If I'm walking into an ambush, I wouldn't mind a counter trap," she replied.
Edvard smiled and flipped his target coordinates to Poulsen. "One surprise coming right up."
"Hang on!"
In hindsight, Edvard realized that he should have, if nothing else, been watching his shuttle's velocity as Poulsen flew them at the space station. He realized her intention less than 5 seconds before the Navy chief rammed the shuttle into the station, still traveling at almost 1,000 kilometers a second. She threw every mass manipulator to offsetting their deceleration, but an equivalent 100,000 gravities could only be reduced so much. Poulsen was wrapped in an emergency acceleration pod, and the Marines had their battle armor, and Edvard still felt like an angry giant had stepped on him.
"Delivered to target,"
Poulsen gasped, heaving deep breaths between words.
20 meters that way," she gestured forwards. "Lasers firing now."
Before Edvard could ask just what that meant, the assault shuttle's forward lasers opened fire. Multi-purpose weapons, primarily intended to defend against missiles but quite capable of taking down atmospheric fighters or other small spacecraft, tore through the structure of the station like superheated wrecking balls.
"Go, go, go!"
he ordered, suiting actions to words as the shuttle bay doors slammed open into the slagged mess that had been the corridors and rooms between the shuttle and the promenade he'd marked as his destination. Ramirez grabbed his shoulder, armored gauntlets holding the officer's battle armor in check.
"Pretending to be League or not, you don't lead from the front, sir," he said gently
as two fire teams swept past, rifles tracking across the debris and the gallery, looking for targets. Targets that weren't there.
"Riley, report,"
Edvard snapped as he entered the promenade he'd expected to find the Terrans in.
"Watch for incoming. They're not in the gallery.
If they're not setting up an ambush there, everybody halt! Prep for ambush close!"
Things were silent on both Edvard's end and hers for several seconds. Then the shooting started and Riley cursed.
"Fuckers! Just in time, sir," she told him. "First squad, suppressive fire. Second squad, pull back and join the line."
Edvard waited patiently for her to have time for him again.
"They had ambushes prepped in the side corridors, but somebody panicked when we halted," she told him. "No losses, but I'm pulling my horns in to cover our asses. Not sure, but we could be facing half a company or more. We're not advancing, sir."
"We can swing around and take them from the rear,"
Edvard offered, studying the map. He could, but...
"We'll be fine," Riley replied. "I know I have a cute ass, but I don't need it hauled out of the fire today, boss. Make your call."
"Behave, Lieutenant,"
the Lieutenant Major said absently as he drew lines on the map in his implant.
"We're going for the command center. Don't die on me."
"Wouldn't dream of it,"
she said breathlessly, a moment before gunfire echoed at a volume that had to be her shooting at somebody.
"Good luck,"
he told her, gesturing Ramirez and the squad sergeant over to him.
"We're heading for the command center. I'm flipping you a map. Let's move." "I can see at least one point where they're going to make trouble for us,"
the gunny told him, highlighting the choke point in front of the command center.
"The command center is going to be fortified,"
Edvard agreed.
"Let's just be glad it's not surrounded by vacuum this time, shall we?"
The last Terran space station Edvard had assaulted had been a prison, with a 100-meter moat of hard vacuum to secure the prison component. Since they'd had such a nice security barrier, they'd used it to protect one side of their command center. Carefully keeping himself in the middle of the squad, Edvard watched his Marines follow his carefully laid out path through the station, running into surprisingly little in the way of resistance. No Marines, no sealed internal bulkheads, nothing. Until they reached the choke point outside the bridge, where the point fire teams rounded a corner and then immediately dove back for cover.
"Security bulkhead is closed and auto turrets are active," the Lance Corporal reported. "No Marines, though. Just automatic defenses."
"How long to hack them?" he asked. Ramirez shrugged.
"Bravo's EW expert is with 3rd Squad," he noted. "Unless we want Poulsen to extract the shuttle and ram another hole in the station to pick up Alpha or Charlie Platoon's EW guys."
"I don't think that shuttle is flying anywhere ever again," Edvard replied. "But if it's just auto turrets, grenades on the bounce, people. Download the point team's visuals and blow those turrets to hell in 5.
Moments later, 20 high-explosive grenades went around the corner with carefully calculated bounces. They didn't hit together. Tiny differences in response time between different Marines spreading the attack over about half a second, but they turned the antechamber of the station's command center into a concentrated inferno.
"On the bounce! Move!" Ramirez bellowed,
the gunny leading the point teams back around the corner. One auto turret was still active, spitting high-velocity penetrators at the Marines. One of the point team Marines took a round to the leg, going down in a crashing heap of ceramic and alloy as his comrades took out the turret.
"I'm fine," she ground out a moment later. "Suit sealed the wound. Not walking anywhere."
"Move her into cover. Demo team, blow the bulkhead," Edvard ordered.
The wounded out of the way, the rest of the platoon followed as the two demolition troops set charges.
"With me on the blast," Edvard ordered. "Remember, we need them to surrender. No one dies who doesn't pull a gun."
Affirmatives responded, and then the explosives blew and they were moving. The suits had built-in stunners for circumstances just like this, and Edvard armed them as he charged through the debris. There were two Marines in the control room, neither in battle armor, but both behind bipod-mounted anti-armor rifles. They were expecting an attack, but his people had the advantage regardless. Electron lasers pulsed in the smoke, and both men went down before they could fire. Edvard ignored them, striding forward and hunting the man he knew had to be there, the older man in the Navy uniform at the center of the room.
"Commodore Arkwright," he said flatly, leveling his rifle at the unarmored man. "The time for games is up. Order your people to stand down."
"And if I refuse?"
the Terran replied contemptuously, staring down the barrel of the gun. He certainly had fortitude, for all that Edvard wanted to hate the old man's guts.
"You die, and I find someone who is willing to order them to surrender," the Marine said coldly.
"Ve victis, Commodore.
You are defeated."
Chapter 27. Aurelius System. 1410, June 5th, 2736, Earth Standard Meridian Date Time. Cataphract D, Command Starfighter. The two gas giants exchanged atmosphere in an immense funnel cloud linking the two worlds, creating one of the single largest natural obstacles Russell had ever seen in his years as a pilot. The chaotic mess of the Aurelius pair meant that none of the starfighters could safely accelerate at their full capability. Of course, that didn't mean they couldn't do so dangerously, and Wing Commander Russell Rokos took his four understrength squadrons into the heart of the storm at 500 gravities. With 10 minutes headway, the katanas were almost 1,000,000 kilometers ahead of him, around the far side of the gas giant and closing on Echo. The Terrans had reduced acceleration to a more sedate 300 gravities, and his people had brought Chameleon's almost 2,000-kilometer-a-second velocity with them.
"This is Tomasino,"
Echo Squadron's commander reported in.
"We lost Tatiana and her crew, but the rest of us are still here. They fired 2 full salvos of missiles at us to get her, too.
We're looping lower than they're willing to get, but they've got us cut off," the young man said grimly. "I don't think these fighters can take going deeper. We're stuck unless you can relieve us."
"Understood,"
Russell transmitted back.
"Can you launch on them?"
"The last salvo of theirs got lost on its way down. I'm not sure our missiles will do any better heading up," the other pilot admitted. "I can engage, but not without coming under fire myself. Link networks with us through the QCOM. Prep for a time-on-target salvo, the CAG ordered.
Yes, sir.
Russell felt as much as saw his 5th Squadron link in. With the loss of another of Echo Squadron's starfighters to the Katana's missiles, he was down to 34 starfighters from his original 40, and facing the Commonwealth's best hardware.
They'll launch a full minute before we do, boss,
Alvarado pointed out quietly. With the Terrans accelerating away from him, his missiles had to play catch-up, but their missiles were flying right down his people's throats.
I know, he said gruffly. We'll still launch before they hit us. Have everyone prep for a full launch cycle. I know Alpha and Bravo only have one launch left, but Charlie and Delta have two. If the Terrans fired twice at Echo, they've only got one launch left in the tubes.
That one launch was still going to be 80 missiles.
Designate that entire first launch, except for Echo's birds, for a defensive intercept, Russell continued. These Ceresas aren't much better at that than our Starfires are, but every bird they take down is one we don't have to shoot down.
Setting it up, his gunner confirmed. 60 seconds to their range of us, 125 to our range of them. They're still pulling 300 Gs away from us.
Russell grunted acknowledgement. The people he was chasing were paying more attention to keeping Echo corralled than they were to trying to evade him. They knew as well as he did that they had him as badly outclassed as he had them outnumbered.
Should we ask them to surrender? Alvarado asked softly.
That's the boss's shtick, Russell replied. If they want to live, they can surrender on their own. I'm perfectly willing to send a few more Terrans to the void than necessary.
Neither of his flight crew said anything. He doubted they disagreed. They'd lost as many friends in the last year of declared and undeclared war as he had. The pilots they faced today might be rookies, but they were of the same ilk that had killed thousands of Alliance pilots by now.
Katanas are launching missiles.
The words were quiet, drawing attention to what the computers were already reporting. All 20 Katanas had flipped for a few fractions of a second and fired. 80 Javelin fighter attack missiles flashed across space, accelerating toward Russell's people at 1,000 gravities.
Prepare countersalvo, he said calmly. Flight Lieutenant Alvarado has the call.
In the back of his mind, he was aware of Echo Squadron rising out of the lower depths of the gas giant, carving an arcing course that would carry them into missile range of the Katanas, but not lance range.
Missiles launched,
Alvarado announced softly into the silence of the cockpit. 28 starfighters each launched 2 missiles, sending 56 missiles into the teeth of the Terran salvo.
Second salvo in 10 seconds. Coordinating anti-missile fire, laser suites active.
Russell exhaled slowly, taking over control of the positron lance and studying the sensor sweeps of the mess in front of him carefully. The upper reaches of the gas giant's atmosphere barely qualified as such, but they certainly made for a denser combat environment than he was used to.
Missile intercept now.
The sky lit up with explosions, dozens of antimatter warheads going off simultaneously as their happily suicidal brains drove them to collisions and near misses that wiped missile after missile from reality. Russell had sacrificed his own heaviest shot to gut the Terran's only shot, and over half of their salvo vanished in the eye-searing blast wave. That still left a missile per Federation fighter and then some, and Russell turned his attention to the deadly dance of maneuver, lance, and laser that would decide if he lived through the next 90 seconds. Each blip of a potential missile earned a pulse of positrons. Only a handful of the pulses triggered the massive explosion marking an actual hit, but he wove his starfighter through a series of tight spirals, enough to throw off the targeting systems of any incoming missile. A final crescendo of explosions swept over his starfighters, and it was over. 3 more of his starfighters, and 12 of Russell's people, including his Charlie Squadron commander, were gone. The Terrans, however, had shot their bolt. Now they were turning back toward Russell's squadrons, trying to close to lance range. Their lances were heavier than his,
and if they made it to range, they could rip his fighters apart with impunity before his people closed the range. 60 seconds after their missiles blew apart around him, though, Echo Squadron's salvo slammed home. 12 missiles rose out of the depths of the gas giant, screaming in on the katanas at 1,000 gravities. With 20 starfighters, the Terrans took them all down, but only at the cost of focusing their defenses toward the gas giant. 10 seconds later, over 30 missiles came screaming down on them from Russell's force, and 12 more rose up from Echo. They tried, but it was in moments of stress like these where experience made all of the difference. The combat experience most of the Terran pilots didn't have. Russell's face was harsh as the explosions worked their way through the katanas, shredding starfighter after starfighter, and leaving their broken formation vulnerable as Echo's third and final salvo arrived. Chapter 28. Aurelius System. 1600, June 5th, 2736, Earth Standard Meridian Date Time. TCN Logistics Depot, Aurelius. Lieutenant Major Hansen met Kyle and Glass in the landing bay as the third wave of shuttles disgorged more of Federation Intelligence's professional looters. With over a quarter of Chameleon's crew tearing apart the entire depot, the whole affair was making him nervous. "Are we sure we have the entire crew contained?" he asked the Marine CO. "No," Hansen admitted. "We do have the Marines and MPs accounted for, as well as all of the armories. We've killed surveillance throughout the station, and my troops are accompanying our search parties. The main threat at this point is Discovery, not a hold-up sensor tech with a pistol," the Marine noted. "There's no way they didn't call for help."
"And the nearest warship is 4 days away,"
Glass reminded them both, the old man glancing around the shuttle bay as crates of something were loaded onto the shuttle.
"We can fill our holds before then, so long as we're efficient and choose what we steal carefully."
"Munitions first," Kyle said firmly. "The next time we go up against the TCN, I want to have more than one salvo of capital ship missiles." "Our computer techs are ripping into their systems as we speak," Hansen promised. "They expect to have at least a basic inventory of the external cargo containers by 2000 hours.
"Those are where we'll find the real prizes," Glass said. "There'll be some munitions and so forth in ready transfer bays on the main station, but it's the cargo containers that will have the main stockpiles."
"I also understand there's a vault in this station?" Kyle asked.
"We've located 7 so far, actually," Hansen reported. "Not entirely sure what's going to be in them beyond high-value, low-volume stuff. I'm hesitant to blast them open."
"Cut them out and bring them with us," Kyle suggested. "That will give us time to work over their systems and get into them at our leisure. We get the value, and we don't distract ourselves inside our timeline." Hansen nodded slowly.
"We can do that," he confirmed. "We'll probably want to run secondary power lines. Make sure their emergency systems don't destroy whatever's in them. Still, a lot of work."
"Missiles and munitions are handy, but no one should turn down loot either," Kyle told him. The surveillance might be shut down, but he still didn't want to get too explicit while aboard the station. The pirates they were pretending to be wouldn't leave the vaults, so they wouldn't. Anything of value would be turned over to the Federation, but the crew would split about a 5% chunk of that value between them. Across some 4,000 people, it wasn't likely to add up to much, but it would still likely be a nice bonus for the people he dragged hundreds of light years from home.
"What have we done with the prisoners?" he asked.
"Shoved them in a hold half full of food and followed them with enough bedrolls and portable toilets for everyone," Hansen replied. "We're watching them carefully, but Arkwright got them sorted out surprisingly quickly."
"That is one terrifying old man," Kyle observed.
"Watch him."
"Like a hawk, Captain," the Marine promised.
"Like a fucking hawk."
"What am I looking at?"
Edvard demanded, ducking past a door that had miraculously acquired a pair of Marine guards, both dressed in a haphazard mix of gear and armor that belied the precision of their stance.
"You'll see,"
Ramirez promised, leading the officer past a chattering swarm of Navy techs.
"When the hacker boys opened up the files, they found something I figured we wanted to bounce all the way up the chain ASAP.
Then we should be bouncing it, not playing 20 questions, the lieutenant major pointed out. Why the mystery?
Take a look,
his gunny replied, switching the lights in one of the ready cargo bays, the bays on the exterior of the station designed to be linked up with the equivalent bays on a warship and have their entire contents transferred over. The lights flickered up on rows upon rows of starfighters. Sets of five ships had been locked together with girders for ease of transport, cables linking from emergency ports to the carrying cases, showing how the thrusters and mass manipulators were sent up to run in tandem. The Terran Commonwealth Starfighter Corps organized its ships into 10 fighter squadrons. Unless Edvard missed his count, he was looking at a minimum of 6 such squadrons, neatly boxed for transport, about the only state in which Alliance hackers had a snowball's chance of taking control of them.
So we have munitions of every type we could possibly desire, parts to manufacture more munitions if we get the other raw materials, and a pile of vaults and high-value goods that will make the crew very happy when we get home. Kyle summarized the essence of the presentation Glass's people had just given on the contents of the inventory files.
What's our transfer timeline look like? He asked, glancing at Chownik.
Assuming the inventory records are correct, I want to prioritize hard munitions over anything else, the XO said. We should have our Stormwind magazines full by 0900 hours tomorrow, at which point we can move on to starfighter missiles, general supplies, and the high-value items. Complete loading should take no more than 48 hours, Chownik concluded. At any point after 900 hours, we should be sufficiently supplied as to carry out the next stage of operations.
Even aboard Chameleon, surrounded by the officers who would be planning the attack, none of them were quite comfortable talking about attacking Tau Ceti yet. It was a Commonwealth core system, after all.
So if someone shows up for lunch tomorrow, we can flip them the engines and be out of here without worrying about it, Kyle said with satisfaction. I like it. I've got a wrench, unfortunately, he continued, one that's going to come down on Mr. Rokos's shoulders.
The CAG hadn't quite been asleep in the corner, though he'd clearly been feeling the adrenaline and other effects of the earlier battle. At the mention of his name, however, the burly man straightened and started paying more attention.
Sir? He said questioningly.
The hackers found something that wasn't in the inventory, Kyle told them. It seems that they were only partway through the transfer of the katanas. He held up a hand to curb any excess of enthusiasm.
There's good news and bad news here. The bad news is that while we found katanas in the station, all of them have been, quite sensibly, broken free of their transport matrices and restored to full systems security, he warned them.
I'll leave it to Glass if those are likely to be useful to us. We'll be bringing at least 2 squadrons worth with us as cargo, but if we can actually man and deploy some of them, we will. The good news is that someone was being nice and ahead of the ball dealing with their old fighters. Major Edvard's people found 50 scimitars in transport matrices, with their systems unlocked for ease of transport. Now, this doesn't give us access to weapons control or their electronic warfare software, but it does give us the ability to overwrite that code.
Mr. Glass, I don't suppose we have copies of the software for the scimitar?
The spy chuckled.
As a matter of fact, we do, he allowed.
It's not a perfect match, much more generic, and they'll suffer for the lack of QCOMs after we got their Terran Q-blocks, but we can make it up with dirty tricks packages borrowed from the League Condottieri.
The Scimitar, honestly, isn't really a superior fighter to the Cataphract D, Kyle warned Rokos. But it is a better missile platform, with twice as many launchers, and one that our Commonwealth friends are going to assume is theirs until it's too late.
We'll take them, Rokos said flatly. That's an edge I won't throw away without a damn good reason. What about the katanas, sir?
We don't have a software suite we can force in over the old code, Glass admitted. We'll need to actually crack open and take control of their existing software. It'll take time and, well, it's not something pirates would be able to do.
But it's not out of the capability of the better Condottieri units? Kyle asked.
No,
the spy confirmed. It doesn't hurt our cause if we make the Commonwealth think we're actual League mercs instead of League-based pirates, Chameleon's captain pointed out. We'll take them for R&D to rip apart anyway, so if we get any of them set up for our use, Rokos can use them. I can see some sneaky uses for having the same starfighters the Terrans do.
Chapter 29. Aurelius System. 2300, June 5th, 2736, Earth Standard Meridian Date Time. Chameleon. Once the aftermath, planning, and discussions were over, it was late by the ship's clock. Kyle found himself pacing his office, unable to even consider sleep. A beer, one of his microbrews from Castle, probably mind-bogglingly expensive at this end of the galaxy, sat on his desk, open but untouched. In the middle of the battle, he hadn't had time to doubt himself. When things had gone sideways, he'd done what he'd always done, gone for the throat while making the enemy look somewhere else. Despite his fear, he apparently still was the Stellar Fox. He sighed. Tatiana Nazarov, Levon Kevorkian, and Norman Costa had died because they'd gone with a different plan. He wasn't sure about the other pilots they'd lost, and he could convince himself they would have lost the Marines either way. But Nazarov's flight crew had died because Echo Squadron had been off on their stealthy own. A clever plan, a sneaky plan, but not the aggressive one he'd conceived of, sitting in that briefing room. It had been a risky plan, but not an all-or-nothing throw of the dice. Until, of course, everything had gone wrong, and an all-or-nothing plan had been the only way to win. To his surprise, a buzz at his door announced the presence of Wing Commander Rokos. His last CAG, Michael Stanford, killed at Hui Xing when Kyle had messed up, had spent many evenings drinking with him, but they'd been friends as well as co-workers. He was too senior to Rokos to have the same relationship, though that required distance could cause problems as well.
Come in, he ordered.
Rokos stepped through the door, looking like a train had run over him.
Couldn't sleep, the CAG said gruffly. System said you were still up. Figured I'd check if you needed company.
You're more than welcome, Kyle said with a grin. Beer?
Sure, just one, Rokos insisted. Still got work to do in the morning.
You're in command, CAG, the captain pointed out, pulling a second bottle from the fridge. When do you ever not?
When I'm not aboard ship, the CAG admitted, taking the beer. Still have letters to write before I sleep. With Flight Commander Zitnik dead, I'm due the letter to her mother, and the letters for her squadron's dead. Do you need help? Kyle asked.
That was part of his job, if needed.
Not with the writing, Rokos replied. Just moral support. This is going to be worth it, right?
Kyle sighed. You saw Intel's projections, he said. It wasn't a question. Kyle had fought hard to make sure his senior officers had access to that report. Walking Stick is going to see reinforcements of over 100 capital ships in the next year. With the reserve going into commission, we'll launch 50. The numbers don't get any better going forward. We need to change the parameters of this war, no matter what the cost.
So we drag an innocent nation into a war with the Commonwealth, Rokos pointed out. Is that a cost we're prepared to accept?
The truth? Kyle sighed. The truth is that if the Commonwealth stops to talk to the League, this whole thing comes apart. We're counting on them to do what they've always done, and on Periklos to respond in a way the League has never responded before. There are diplomatic moves in play as well, he reminded Rokos. If the League goes to war with the Commonwealth, we'll offer them an alliance. Starting a second front has value all on its own, but if we can coordinate with the League, suddenly we can face the Commonwealth on something approaching an even footing. That's worth a lot, Rokos.
Can't argue, the CAG said, shaking his head. Still seems dirty.
It's a black op we can never admit we were involved in, Kyle agreed.
It's dirty, all right. Using their own starfighters against them? Stolen munitions? Stolen birds? Gods, Chameleon was theirs, not that we stole it from them.
We didn't start this war,
Roko said quietly.
I don't even like Terrans, sir. But this is a mess.
It is. But it's our job and our mess. Someone was going to do it, Wing Commander. Who better? Rokos laughed.
They might have found a better Kag, he pointed out. But they sure as hell couldn't have found a better captain. Not sure anyone else would have had the nerve to pull off what you did today. Most would have written Echo off and run.
Wasn't going to happen, Rokos, Kyle said with a cheerful grin as the other officer's confidence finished filling a hole he'd barely even realized he'd been struggling with.
Just was not going to happen.
Edvard was drunk. It was a state he generally tried to avoid on deployment, but a second circle of empty chairs at the heart of a second wake in a week was a bit much for him. He'd joined a peacetime military, though everyone had known war was coming. He'd lost more Marines under his command in the last 7 days than in the first 7 years of his career. They'd been lucky, too. They'd run up against equal numbers of Terran Marines, and if the Terran commander hadn't fed them into his people piecemeal, he'd have lost more than the dozen men and women he had. With 36 fatalities, Edvard was down almost a fifth of his company. He'd gone a little too far into a whiskey bottle when that realization had hit, and Riley had gently steered him out of the wake before it became necessary for him to trigger the implant override that would flush the alcohol from his system. They'd traveled far from the party, not heading anywhere in particular, when he stumbled and fell into her. She tried to catch him, but that only resulted in them both going down in a tangled heap of limbs and uniforms. Lieutenant Sandra Riley was, quite literally, a killing machine. Her body augmented with various systems that made her extremely dangerous despite her slim build. Hearing her giggle was an unexpected pleasure. Sharing her laughter, Edvard tried to disentangle himself from his subordinate, only to suddenly find them face to face, still sprawled along the floor, and with far more of their bodies touching than the articles would ever find acceptable. They both froze then. Ever so slightly, Riley's lips parted and she leaned toward him. And then an emergency alert hit both their implants, causing them to scramble apart as Edvard finally engaged the override that cut the effect of alcohol on his brain.
Hansen, what's happening? He demanded.
Sir, we have a problem,
the sergeant running the security detail on the Terran prisoners said hesitantly.
So I'm assuming, Edvard snapped.
What's happened?
It seems Commodore Arkwright found the guy running the marine defense of the station. He's kicking the shit out of the man. Should we intervene?
Edvard had to think about that for a longer moment than he was really comfortable with. The pirates they were pretending to be were only somewhat likely to care, but neither the condottieri they were also pretending to be or the Marines they were could really let that stand. Even if the Terran Marines' CO had managed to kill off most of his own people with incompetence.
Yes, he ordered. Break it up and see if we can sort out somewhere to throw them both to cool off.
Will do, sir,
the Marine replied. The mental image of Arkwright, the calmly collected old man who'd almost refused to surrender at gunpoint, beating up a presumably much younger and likely much healthier man, still amused Edvard. Enough to keep him smiling until he turned to meet Riley's gaze and remembered what had been happening when he'd received the message. There was an unfamiliar pallor to her face that told him that she'd also triggered the override to flush the alcohol from her brain and the rest of her body. She met his gaze and smiled shyly. He shook his head wryly, both acknowledging what had almost happened. They both knew it wouldn't have ended at a kiss, and warning her that it couldn't happen.
We're adults, sir, she said quietly. We can behave.
So we can, he agreed with a sigh. May I walk you to your quarters, Lieutenant Riley?
By the time Russell finished his beer and headed back to his quarters, the fatigue of the day had finally caught up with him. The burly pilot wasn't really having problems, per se, but he was definitely looking forward to his bed. Passing the flight lounge, however, he caught a flicker of light. Flickering wasn't generally a good sign on a starship. It usually meant there was a problem with the power feed to an entire section of the ship. Flickering lights often meant that section of the ship wasn't far away from flickering life support. He turned toward the lounge, concern overcoming fatigue for at least a few moments, only to stop as he reached the entrance to the room and realized he was seeing candlelight. Candles were discouraged outside the handful of religious shrines aboard Federation warships, but they weren't exactly forbidden. He paused at the door, outside of sight from most of the room, and looked to see what was happening. Cavendish was sitting at a table off to the side of the lounge, a set of lit candles laid out in front of her. Five others that he recognized as flight crew from her Black Ops squadron sat around the table with her, each with three candles in front of them. One for each of Echo Squadron's people who died today. It wasn't something he was familiar with, but he could also see how a unit that operated as insularly as Cavendish's had before being assigned to Chameleon would have its own rituals and traditions. He stayed in the corner for a moment, watching the Black Ops flight crew and their candles. Despite his inability to hear their quiet conversation, he still felt like he was intruding. He slowly withdrew, making sure to make his way past the lounge without coming into their view. The candles were a minor fire hazard, but not enough to be worth commenting on. Everyone had the right to mourn in their own way. Chapter 30. Aurelius System. 1200, June 6th, 2736, Earth Standard Meridian Date Time. Chameleon.
Watch it! Those are missiles, for star's sake!
Why? It's not loaded with antimatter yet.
Maybe not,
the chief agreed with her heckler.
But if you damage the containment fields when we fill it with antimatter, the whole shebang will explode, and then you don't get the lunch you're rushing to because the whole ship will be gone.
Kyle smiled slightly at the perennial sound of senior non-coms explaining their subordinates' failings to them, watching as another cell of 12 Stormwind capital ship missiles drifted through the zero-gravity connection between the logistics depot and the Q-ship.
Our ready magazines are now full,
Chownik reported crisply, the two men standing in an observation bay watching the loading process.
That's 120 missiles. As a reserve, we're loading another 480 in the cargo holds like that.
The cyborg gestured toward the packaged missiles with one plastic and chrome finger.
We can't transfer them into the magazines quickly, but even a 10-minute load cycle is better than no reloads at all.
Agreed, Kyle confirmed. The starfighter missiles?
A 20th the size, so the numbers are bigger, but the story's the same,
his XO replied.
When the Terrans designed her, they gave us 20 missile magazines for each Stormwind launcher, and 80 missile magazines for the Javelin launchers. We've loaded the best part of 1,000 missiles into the magazines, and since the Scimitars need them as well, we're stacking 10,000 spares into one of the holds.
That must have made Rokos happy.
Like a kid at Christmas, Chownik agreed. We've also loaded in an entire company's worth of battle armor and weapons for the Marines, plus enough munitions to fight a good-sized war.
He shrugged.
We can manufacture most of that, given time, but it seems handy to have around. I did make the call to leave behind the combat vehicles, though,
the XO told Kyle.
While I'm sure imaginative enough officers could find a use for a main battle tank aboard a space station, carrying them didn't seem cost-effective.
Did Hansen even complain? Kyle asked.
I'm not sure the lieutenant major even noticed the tanks were an option, or cared. He was busy gloating over the container of anti-armor carbines we found.
The starfighters?
We're moving the cataphracts into the cargo hold with the katanas we brought over,
Chownik noted.
Once that's done, we'll begin moving the scimitars into the main flight deck. Rokos has two squadrons flying combat space patrol until the transfer is complete.
My understanding is that the software work is already done, and Rokos's people will be able to fly the birds as soon as they're fueled and armed.
Good work, Chownik, Kyle concluded. Anything else going on I need to be aware of?
Something is going to break, his exo pointed out pessimistically. I expected it to be with the missiles, but the catastrophic failure point now is the starfighter loading. For about 6 hours, those 12 birds Rokos has up are it for our defenses. We're attached to the station, and the rest of the cataphracts are in cold storage.
Kyle had signed off on the plan recognizing the risk. That was why they had the CSP, but he understood his XO's concern. This was the most vulnerable stage of the whole operation. Russell watched uncomfortably as the last of his undeployed cataphracts slotted neatly into the frameworks that carried them through deep space. While there were connections between the cargo bays and the flight deck, they weren't large enough, aboard Chameleon at least, to move the starfighters themselves. So he was going to have most of his remaining fighters moved out of the flight deck and into the cargo bay, a relatively straightforward process that would unfortunately tell anyone watching that he didn't currently have any more starfighters to deploy. Then they would move the scimitars in similar frameworks, break them down, adjust the hangars to fit the completely different style of spacecraft, check that the systems were all working as Glass had promised, and only then fuel them and load them with missiles. 6 hours, Hans told him. He hated to call his tech chief a liar, but he doubted they'd do it in less than 12. He had Echo and Bravo squadrons, his most intact formations at this point with 6 fighters apiece, flying CSP.
That's it, Hans said sharply from behind him. We'll move them out and have the new birds in here in a jiffy, boss.
Should have done this in deep space, Rokos told her. We could have waited.
Could we? She asked. I'm not in the operations briefings, Kag. Are we going to have 6 hours to stop in deep space and make the switch like this?
He snorted. The plan was to head straight to Tau Ceti.
Probably not, he admitted. It just makes me twitchy.
You're just grouchy you couldn't justify flying the CSP yourself.
Fair, he agreed. But if you'll excuse me, Chief Hans, I'm going to go baby the tactical plot in Pryfly until this is over.
The fighter frames were making their final ungainly way back into Chameleon as Russell entered the Q-ship's primary flight control center. With as much local traffic as there was, the room was a hub of activity, with the techs providing safe courses and corrections to the 12 starfighters and almost 60 assorted other small craft swarming around Chameleon and the depot. One screen was showing footage from one of those shuttles, hanging back to provide assistance if something went wrong, watching another shuttle winch in the cables linked to a vault the size of a starfighter. None of the vaults had contents listed in the inventories their hackers had yet accessed, but it was unlikely something with that level of protection wouldn't be worth the effort to haul it out of the station. Bravo Squadron was flying a high overwatch, orbiting above the depot in a position to intercept an approach from any attack. Echo Squadron was doing the opposite, orbiting below the chaotic space of the depot, where the engines and energy of the station helped conceal the already stealthy starfighters. The hope was that if someone attacked, Echo's intervention would come as a surprise. It was a pretty frail hope, in Russell's opinion, as the man who drafted the plan, but the truth was that any surprise was unnecessary. At most, there was a loose patrol of katanas in the system somewhere. A dozen cataphracts should be able to deal with that without any games.
How are we doing, Flight Commander?
He quietly asked Shine, the Space Force officer running the shift. Shine was one of exactly 2 officers in the Space Force contingent who lacked the necessary implant bandwidth to fly a starfighter, and the black-eyed woman lacked it for the same reason as Kyle Roberts did, neural scarification-induced implant degradation. Shine, like Captain Roberts, had been just too close to an antimatter warhead going off. She'd lived, but she'd been grounded and offered an Article 17 medical discharge. Instead, she'd taken a support role normally assigned to officers who'd pissed off their CAGs. Running Pryfly was a job she was sharing with Cavendish, for example. Unlike Cavendish, she'd volunteered for it so she could still contribute.
It's a hornet's nest out there, but it's our hornet's nest,
Shine said cheerfully. Scanners are clear of anything we don't know about.
She pointed at one corner of the holographic plot as she spoke, though. Aurelius 4A was finishing its spin around 4B and approaching the depot. All three were orbiting the shared center of gravity, so at different times, different planets would be closest to the station, more driven by the station's orbit than the planet's rotation around each other.
Costner, you said you were going to dig into that sensor blotch you spotted, she called to one of her techs. Why is it still showing as an unknown on my plot?
Haven't seen anything since, the tech replied. It could have been an engine flare, but nothing's shown up since. He shrugged. It might be a platform or a Q-probe they had in orbit down there, or it could be a sensor glitch.
Is there any way to be sure? Russell asked.
We could pulse the entire area with the main radar array, Costner said slowly. We're using it for local sweeps, but we could do a high-power pulse along the line of the ghost. But it's just a ghost.
I don't believe in ghosts, the CAG told him. I do believe in sneaky Terrans. Run the radar pulse, specialist.
Yes, sir.
It took a few seconds to redirect the several emitters that made up the main radar array. Russell waited impatiently as the immensely powerful beams of radiation were charged and then unleashed toward Aurelius 4A. More seconds ticked by, the speed of light having its own piece to say in the timing of their data, and then the sensor ghost lit up again and started to resolve.
Damn,
Shine whispered.
Vampire,
she shouted, getting the attention of everyone in the Pryfly Center.
We have vampires! 5 katanas on approach! Come on, people,
she snapped as some of her crew stared at her blankly while others leapt to work.
You know the drill! Check your sectors and responsibilities. Get the shuttles to safe zones and clear attack vectors for the starfighters. We have 60 unarmed ships out there, and it's our job to make sure we don't lose any.
Russell left her to it and stepped up behind Costner.
Get me details, son, he said quietly.
They're at 500,000 kilometers, closing at 2,000 kilometers per second, the scanner tech reported.
They're in missile range, Russell realized.
Get me Tomasino!
Too late,
the tech whispered, gesturing at the screen. The 5 starfighters had just brought their drives up at full power and were pushing up from the gas giant they'd hidden their acceleration behind. They'd approached from wherever they'd been patrolling in the system and used Aurelius 4A to set up a slingshot maneuver and sneak up on the depot with their engines down. All 5 fighters launched, sending 20 missiles blasting toward the collection of shuttles and small transport ships Shine was attempting to coordinate. Only some of them had any kind of anti-missile defenses at all, and Chameleon's defenses couldn't cover them all.
Cag, this is Tomasino,
Echo Squadron's acting commander's voice sounded in his ear.
I see them. We are vectoring to intercept the missiles.
Bravo is on their way to reinforce you,
Russell told the younger man, as if that made a difference. Even as they spoke, a second salvo of 20 missiles launched into space. Bravo Squadron would be able to drop missiles on the Terrans, make sure that none of the Katanas survived their suicide strike. But they wouldn't be able to intervene in the missile strike. The only way to save the shuttles was to put Echo Squadron's 6 starfighters between them and the missiles, and then use their ECM to lure the missiles to them.
We will do our duty, sir,
Tomasino said calmly, far more calmly than Russell would have felt in his place. The only way to save the shuttles was to make the missiles try to kill Echo Squadron.
Missiles away, Taylor announced grimly.
Kyle nodded absently, studying the tactical plot as he tried to see a way out of the situation for the squadron trapped between the oncoming Terrans and the defenseless small craft now swarming to try and hide behind Chameleon. The Q-ship was locked to the station, but unlike in New Edmonton, they had missiles to spend this time. 6 Stormwinds flashed into space toward the attacking starfighters, and a dozen javelins followed them. More javelins followed in rapid succession, Taylor putting salvo after salvo of the smaller missiles into space in a counter-missile pattern that would cover the space shuttles, eventually.
Their third salvo doesn't stand a chance, she told him. Their second. We'll only get salvo in space in time to intercept.
That's 12 missiles against 20.
He nodded again, more grimly. On a good day, a Javelin had a 30% success rate as a counter-missile, which meant most of that second salvo would get through. Worse, there was nothing they could do about the first 20 missiles.
Bravo Squadron has launched on the Katanas, Chownik reported.
The XO was on the bridge for once, but had readily taken up his normal role relaying information from the CIC crew.
We're assessing a 0% survival chance. Those bastards are done.
They knew that going in, Kyle said quietly. They were hoping to get to Lance range, but they launched as soon as they were seen.
He crunched the numbers in his implant, but it didn't change anything. They'd disabled Aurelia Station's anti-missile defenses to stop any loose Terrans from turning them on the shuttles. Chameleon's own defenses provided a safe zone that covered many of the unarmed craft, but those first two salvos would reach the ships outside that zone before they could evade.
There's nothing else we can do, he told his bridge crew, his voice calm and confident, somehow. It's up to Tomasino's people.
Russell racked his brain as the Terrans closed, trying to find some way that they could intervene from there, but it all boiled down to hard math. The Katanas had launched 60 missiles, and Echo Squadron had 6 starfighters. Any missiles from the first two salvos that got through would kill shuttles. About a third of the spacecraft under threat had the same crew as the starfighters, a Navy pilot, co-pilot, and engineer. The rest had more. Bigger crews on larger craft, shuttles with passengers.
Costner, he snapped, keep those arrays on the Terrans. At this range, Chameleon should be able to read the damn serial numbers on the missiles. Feed the data back to Echo.
On it,
the tech replied. It was all he could give Flight Lieutenant Tomasino, but it wasn't nothing. At this range, focusing Chameleon's main radar arrays would overwhelm any attempt to jam scanners or otherwise obfuscate the missile's location. Normally, that kind of focus was dangerous, but anything that hadn't been hiding in Aurelius 4A's shadow would be seen coming, and anything following the Katanas would be caught in the same focused scans.
We've got them dialed in, Shine said quietly at his shoulder. Will it be enough?
It has to be,
Russell replied harshly. More icons flashed onto the screen as Tomasino's people launched their own javelins, emptying their magazines in less than 20 seconds to send 36 missiles into the teeth of the Terran's 20. Explosions rippled through space as the salvos intersected, 3 sets of explosions lighting the sky as each of the Federation salvos struck home. Even with the radar hammering the entire area, the explosions from the last missile intercept faded to reveal far too many surviving missiles. There were a few seconds of silence. Then Echo Squadron's lasers and positron lances ripped into the remaining missiles and lit up a new series of explosions. The series of fireballs reached a crescendo and then faded away to show only 4 starfighters remaining. But none of the missiles had made it through.
Chameleon's missiles intercepting,
Costner reported softly. There were a lot fewer missiles to intercept the incoming weapons this time, though they did better than the Federation crews had any right to expect. Fully half of the second salvo disappeared in the massive fireballs of mutual annihilation. The last 10 missiles bore down on Echo Squadron's 4 remaining starfighters, and Russell held his breath in horror as their defensive suites reached out and met the incoming. He waited.
Breakthrough! Costner snapped. We have 2 missiles running in. They're heading for the station.
That wasn't a possibility that had occurred to Rokos. Destroying the depot station would kill several thousand TCN personnel, but it would also prevent Chameleon from stealing any more of the vast quantities of munitions and other resources aboard the platform. It wasn't the call he would have made, but he could see the logic of the Terran commander. They'd committed to a suicide mission and apparently had decided everyone else got to die as well.
There has to be something, he whispered. Chameleon's defenses covered the station, right?
They should, Shine agreed. It depends on... Son of a bitch!
Both missiles blew apart as something blurred back around.
Report!
The shift supervisor demanded.
One of our assault shuttles, Costner said slowly. Navy Chief Poulsen piloting. She got one with the lasers.
They're both gone, Shine replied, then paused as what Costner had said caught up.
My gods.
She rammed the other, the tech said quietly. There was no one else aboard.
What about Echo Squadron?
Russell demanded, his attention turning back to his people as he confirmed the station was safe. The last salvo had run into the solid wall of Chameleon's missiles, and the katanas were running from the missiles Taylor had earmarked for them.
I have one fighter on the screens, Costner reported after a moment of silence. Flight Lieutenant Volger's Echo 3, sir. No one else.
Please tell me those bastards aren't getting away, Russell said, his voice feeling carved from stone.
Chapter 31. Aurelius System. 2000 June 6th, 2736 Earth Standard Meridian Date Time. Chameleon.
There was a four-person flight crew on Assault Shuttle 9 when Chief Poulsen realized what was going on, Chownik reported quietly to the rest of Chameleon's senior officers. There wasn't even enough time for her to explain what was happening. The gap between the missiles breaking past Echo Squadron and her interception zone was 22 seconds. Assault shuttles are designed for hostile environments and have seat-by-seat ejection mechanisms for an emergency. Chief Poulsen triggered all of them but hers, and then went after the missiles. The briefing room was silent for a long moment. Aurelius Station is not designed for combat, the XO noted. While most warships can take several near misses or even a direct hit and stay in action, the depot could not. A single gigaton-range warhead would have vaporized approximately 40% of the station and killed at least 500 of our people and most of the Terran prisoners aboard.
We lost 16 people today, Kyle said grimly. They sacrificed themselves to save over 3,000.
Lieutenant Tomasino knew exactly what he was doing when he put his squadron in front of those missiles. Chief Poulsen could have followed orders, evaded action exactly as she was supposed to. But she'd had the only armed spacecraft with an interception profile. She'd made the same choice Kyle would have in her place, and he saluted her for it. While the files and details will be classified and buried, I've recommended all of Tomasino's flight crew for Stars of Heroism and recommended the Senatorial Medal of Valor for Chief Becca Poulsen. Flight Lieutenant Vogel and his two crew members would receive the only awards on that list that weren't posthumous. They were heroes, but the records would be sealed. No one would ever know why those pilots and crew had never come home. With the destruction of that patrol, I believe we have accounted for any remaining loose starfighters, Kyle noted. But we do have three of our Q-probes sweeping the system for further stragglers. Their vectors will bring them back aboard in 24 hours. That will guard our back while we finish loading, and when they return, we are leaving this system, he finished firmly. Is that going to be a problem?
The scimitars are aboard and being checked out, Rokos reported. The last of the cataphracts were heading into storage as I came over here, and we have two squadrons of the scimitars ready to deploy. Flight ops will be ready to go in 24 hours.
I'd prefer longer, Chownik admitted, but we already have the munitions we needed aboard. We're loading food and spare parts at this point. Chameleon still has a lot more cargo capacity than any warship, so it would take us longer to fill her cargo holds than we've got. He shrugged. We can make 24 hours work.
Anyone else?
Kyle asked, glancing around at Taylor, Lau, and Glass.
Good,
he concluded. We are a little over 13 days from Tau Ceti. We'll engage in a little bit of deception as we leave, which will bring us up to approximately 14 days. We will not be stopping for long along the way.
If there is anything you need to do in real space, it needs to be done in the next 24 hours.
What about memorial services, sir?
Chownik asked.
We don't have an obelisk aboard, Kyle replied sadly.
Any Castle Federation warship carried a white stone obelisk with the names of every human being who died aboard her engraved in it. Having one for Chameleon, however, would have risked betraying her true origins should she fall into Commonwealth hands.
I'll talk to the crew come morning, he promised. It's been a rough few days, so I think it's time we told them our final destination. They need to know. Gods, we all need to know that this is going to be worth it.
Edvard hadn't quite fallen asleep when the door to his quarters buzzed for admittance. It was late at night, and anything truly urgent should be arriving via implant message with a priority code. He was seriously considering ignoring it when it buzzed again. With a sigh, he pulled up the hallway footage and saw Riley standing outside his door, glancing back and forth around the hallway. Sighing again, he pinged the door to let her in and got out of bed.
What is it, Sandra? He asked as he stepped out of the sleeping cubicle.
She paused on seeing him and carefully looked him up and down, a gesture that made him remember that he slept in shorts.
Lieutenant, he said sharply.
Sorry, sir. Yes, sir, she replied, yanking her gaze back to his face. We may have a problem, sir.
I'm noticing, Edvard told her.
Not that, Riley replied. To his surprise, he realized she was blushing and that his own face was growing warm.
What kind of problem, Sandra? He asked, throwing his uniform jacket on to cover his torso and reduce the awkwardness of the situation.
I'm worried one of my friends is about to go off the deep end, she admitted. If I'm wrong, even suggesting this could wreck their career. But if I'm right...
Last I checked, all of your friends on this ship were covert operators, Edvard said quietly. That's not my idea of people we want going off the deep end.
Well, you're not a covert operator, she pointed out, then sighed. Look, boss, Edvard, I have no illusions here. Lieutenant Riley has a legal and moral obligation to report my suspicions and have my friend arrested. But that would destroy them. Completely.
So you're hoping for a compromise of some kind, he replied. What do you want from me, Sandra? I am not in the habit of making special cases for my subordinates, he warned her.
With her in his quarters late at night, he was currently quite aware of how attractive he found her. He still wasn't going to let that influence his decisions if he possibly could. I'd hope not, Riley said. I need authorization to put together a contingency plan. She swallowed, then nodded firmly. MP override access to the ship's sensor suites and having at least a few of my people on standby at all times. Those were relatively small requests. Edvard could guess who Riley was concerned about, and she was right. If they had a serious concern, they did have a legal obligation to detain them. But...
All right, he told her. On one condition.
Name it.
The instant you have anything beyond a bad feeling, any evidence that anything is actually being planned, we shut her down hard. No second chances, Sandra. Not even first chances. Understand?
Yes, sir, she said crisply. And thank you, Edvard. He flashed her a smile that he knew was not entirely appropriate for their professional relationship.
Get out of my quarters, Lieutenant Riley.
Kyle sat in the center of the hive of activity that filled Chameleon's bridge in the morning, watching his crew go about their tasks. Everyone was busy, but there was a subdued tone to the affair as well. It was always harder, he knew, to lose people after the battle was supposed to be won. He tapped a command, linking him into the ship's PA system.
This is the captain speaking, he announced, pausing a moment to let people slow down and pay attention. This trip has been a series of gut punches for us all,
he admitted. We've lost a lot of Space Force people and Marines. We lost people aboard Chameleon to the near miss when we took this system, and now Poulsen and more fighter crews to the stragglers. You all know we're on a black operation. There will be no obelisk here to carry the names of our lost forward in the memory of the fleet. No records of their heroism. The citations for their awards will be classified until long after we're all dead. Worse, because it's a black op, you don't know what's happening. You're not sure what Poulsen and Tomasino and the others died for. We've all had our small memorial services for our own immediate comrades, but without the obelisk, we haven't gathered as a crew to mourn our dead. And that hurts. We've lost brothers and sisters, but haven't stood together as a family to remember them. Today, we're buried in work, making sure Chameleon is ready for what's to come. Once we're underway once again, we'll hold that memorial service. I promise. He sighed. We'll hold it because we may not get another chance, people, he warned them. From here, we are going to the heart of the Commonwealth, to challenge the defenses of the Tau Ceti naval yards. The Terrans are developing a new type of starfighter weapon, one that could leave us outclassed as well as outnumbered, he said grimly. If Walking Stick gets these weapons without us knowing what we're facing, he may cut all the way to Castle before we can stop him. No other ship can do this, and I'd have no other crew aboard her when we strike at the heart of the Commonwealth, Kyle continued fiercely. The Federation and the Alliance are relying on us to learn everything we can and to put the fear of the night in the Commonwealth. Today, their leaders look to the stars and are confident that all humanity will be unified and kneel to Terra, to them. When we're done, they'll look to the stars and wonder where the next attack is coming from.
Chapter 32. Aurelius System. 2100 June 7th, 2736, Earth Standard Meridian Date Time. Chameleon. Kyle leaned back in his seat and tried not to openly heave a sigh of relief as Chameleon pulled away from the Aurelius Depot. He'd been reasonably confident there were no more straggler patrols hanging around the system, but the five starfighters they had missed had extracted far too high a toll. As the Q-ship passed the one light second mark, Kyle gave Taylor a silent nod. Several seconds later,